then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 3rd, 2014. Another week has gone by, and we're still waiting for Godot. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Tell you what, let's let Andy kick it off this week.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today, I'm moving on to the practical portion of my real politics talks. The first thing I'm going to do is demonstrate why the basic concepts I've gone over really do matter and how to apply them. Next time, I can actually get around to answering a question the party was asked quite a long time ago. Before I venture into making declarations that one thing is right and another is wrong, I need to use the basics on something obviously wrong, like communism, so that my methods are understood without the added complication of making statements with which some out there might disagree. Years ago, someone approached me about the idea of national Bolshevism as a potential white nationalist ideology. Thankfully, my racial education was well underway at that time, though it was still several months until I would actually come home to the Pacific Northwest myself. I was able to immediately dismantle the idea of white racist Bolshevism as inherently contradictory. But how was I able to do so? I applied a few, well, basics, which I later formalized and presented here on Radio Free Northwest. I'm insistent that every one of you comprehend I'm not doing anything special. I regularly say anyone with a few books and some time on their hands could just as easily deliver these talks provided they were prioritizing reality and ruthlessly abandoning anything inconsistent with it. On that note, it's worth going into my own personal racist history and political education. I promised an anecdote just over a month ago, and this is it. Prior to going full-on racist, I was very politically involved. Thankfully, I had a preference for principle, or else I'd still be a standard Republican asshole. I paid attention just long enough to figure out Republicans aren't the societal saviors they lead us to believe, and I started to slide to the right. I knew enough about history to realize the left and its ultimate expression of communism weren't the way to go. Leftism, and more specifically, communism, is responsible for more suffering and evil than very likely any other ideology in history. That shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone listening to RFN, and with that very well-known fact about communism, any of its varieties such as national Bolshevism could be easily dismissed. While perfectly correct, this answer is superficial. There's a more substantial answer which involves the basics of racial politics. Unfortunately for someone who isn't a white nationalist, this answer is inaccessible even if it is far superior. For years, I deliberately forbade myself from considering race as an issue in politics, thinking that economics, morality, and the size of government were the only things which ought to worry a person. As I had cause to relate to some local comrades last week, I was raised to think I had Jesus in my back pocket, and I could just whip him out anytime I needed to solve a problem. Without going into too much detail, every time I seriously considered significant historical events and issues, race always emerged as a deciding factor. so I ended up going racial. Sure, I even suppress that for a while, but it's not exactly something you can shut off once it gets going. So here's where things get interesting. A non-racist only has economic and moral vocabulary to describe the world, its problems, and their proposed solutions. But even more importantly, white nationalists tend to treat racial understanding like any other type of knowledge. Mathematics is perhaps the best way of illustrating this concept. When someone learns about mathematics, their knowledge constantly expands and builds on what was there before. Racial understanding isn't this way for one very obvious reason. If a non-racist's understanding were sufficiently deep to explain the world around them, no one would ever become a racist in their political development because they would have no need or motivation for doing so. This affects how a person would think about communism after becoming racist. Racial learning shouldn't expand a person's understanding before it first breaks their previous ideas down. Like I said, if someone were on the right track with their political beliefs, they wouldn't be motivated to investigate things which blatantly contradict said beliefs. This is a prime time to recall the stages of learning. Economic, moral, and fiscal problems are certainly worth considering, since they are almost always the impetus behind someone investigating racial reality. But there is a more fundamental concept which shapes all of these fields. That of race. Because race is a more basic and low-level reality than economics or morality, race is the deciding factor and actual actor behind these problems. Therefore, learning about race is not a knowledge expansion, but a knowledge reacquisition, if done correctly. Incorporating race into any political subject should cause someone to bust themselves back down to conscious incompetence. Remember what I said months ago about new knowledge. Learning something you didn't know before can very easily reveal that, despite whatever level of understanding you perceived yourself to have attained, you were really unconsciously incompetent in that field or skill, and race is one of these fields. Maintaining previously held political beliefs, while not impossible or in any way wrong, is certainly difficult when someone acquires a racial outlook. Rather, becoming a racist should compel someone to re-examine their existing ideas from a racial perspective. Many of them will be rightly abandoned entirely. Prior to my own racism, communism seemed to be a massive pile of economic horse dung and perhaps a little bit of anti-religious extremism. And while it may certainly be those things, it is so because of a more fundamental aspect of its root cause. About a month or two after I first began listening to Radio Free Northwest, Harold Covington asked the entire audience if they could define communism. At the time, which was about 3.5 years ago, I almost jumped at my computer and shouted out the various concepts I understood communism to be. Aside from being in the stage of newfound enthusiasm, I was genuinely surprised Harold thought this would be an interesting challenge. But then, something really strange happened. It occurred to me I couldn't actually answer the question. On the following episode, Harold delivered the answer he promised. As it turns out, communism is, by definition, the non-white rebellion against white world authority as led by the Jew. I understand this definition comes from Commander Rockwell, but regardless of the source, it is a far more accurate and simple answer than anything I could have come up with. This answer is far superior because it is cast in terms of basic racial facts and nothing else. I could certainly explain my own half answers in terms of what Commander Rockwell gave us, but there's no reason to. Knowing the importance of race, as I covered it in Realpolitics 4, will make such an answer entirely complete without any other explanation. But then, if someone knows the importance of race, shouldn't they be willing and able to reconsider everything they ever thought in light of racial reality? After all, it could be they didn't actually understand something as well as they thought. And in all candor, there's nothing wrong with that since everyone is learning all the time. That being the case, and armed with the technique used in the example from my segment today, I'm ready to start answering questions the party has been asked. Next time, I plan to discuss a series of inquiries someone made of us regarding the subject of capitalism. Since I've arrived at the practical portion of my Realpolitik series, I'm now opening the floor to questions. I'll make it a point to stay on top of communication should any of you want something addressed in addition to the other things I have already planned. Hail victory, comrades.
Got an email earlier this week from a comrade in New York State. Dear Harold, this week marks the 100th anniversary of World War I. With your understanding of history, can you give your input on this occasion and tell us on RFN the importance of this huge event that is largely forgotten today? Now, I know this is not Northwest related, but since this war started Europe down the path of destruction, I think people should understand its causes and consequences, such as the abolition of monarchies and redrawn maps of the Middle East. Interestingly, I read that Otto von Bismarck predicted it. Thank you very much, Harold. Actually, the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I is August the 4th, but he's referring to the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria in Sarajevo on the 28th of June, and so I know what he means. Odd. That will be two major war centennials that I've gone through in my life. I remember when I was a child the Civil War centennial of the early 1960s. This was back in the days when Confederate history was actually taught in the public schools, and you could bring a Confederate flag, or something with a Confederate flag on it, to school without getting expelled and getting your parents arrested, and getting sent to a shrink to be denazified or whatever, but I digress. I personally consider the Victorian and the Edwardian era, the period from roughly 1840 until 1914, to be the absolute height of white Western civilization in many respects, if not all. True, medical science wasn't nearly as advanced as it is today, and children were still dying of polio and diphtheria, and young people of tuberculosis, but at least medicine was on a scientific basis after a few discoveries, like the existence of microorganisms, got us out of the Middle Ages, and doctors knew to wash their hands before cutting you open, so progress was being made. Now, I realize there was a major problem with buccaneer capitalism during this stage of history, and I wouldn't have wanted to be part of the new urban working class, working 14-hour days in a factory, or some child working in a textile mill or a coal mine. If I had been in that situation back then, I probably would have become a socialist, along with some actually pretty decent white men like Eugene Debs and Jack London, and the early IWW types like Big Bill Haywood. I also realize that for all I defend Christianity against present-day persecution by the forces of Judaism and socialism and buggery, in those days, the United States at least was, in effect, a Christian theocracy run by wealthy, hardcore Protestant bigots of the 700 Club variety, and a lot of white people were marginalized and excluded on stupid grounds like religion or because their names ended in vowels. I know, because growing up in the South in the 1950s and 60s, I kind of caught the tail end of that. For example, in 1970, at Governor's School in North Carolina, the students were all required to go to church on Sunday, which would be just unthinkable today. No one would dare try it. It didn't matter what church, but you had to go. The Jewish kids were exempt, of course, one of the earliest points in my life that I noticed Jews were getting special treatment. And, geez, I'm really rambling off topic here. Look, the Victorian and the Edwardian ages had their problems, I don't deny that, and yet I still maintain that they were the height of white Western civilization. The advancement of pure knowledge and technological strides that we made during that time period were astounding. By the late 19th century, there was the telegraph and the telephone, so men could communicate instantaneously over long distances. Bet you didn't know that in 1888, the London Bobbies used telephones in the hunt for Jack the Ripper. By 1914, there were functioning motor cars and airplanes and the earliest mechanical refrigeration and air conditioning that made productive use of hot climates feasible. Yes, industrialization was a bitch, and I wouldn't have wanted to be slaving away on the factory floor. But contrary to what the liberals and the reds howl about, everything in life is not about some people having to work and others getting to live and create and how unfair it all is. Life was actually, in a lot of ways, much more fair in those days than it is today, or at least it was a lot more open because the white nations of the world had opportunities that they'd never had before. In Britain, through their huge world empire, and in the United States and Canada, through their huge expanse of land that had to be populated and civilized, and through the capitalist system itself, which can actually be quite impressive and a lot of fun when it's expanding and not having to battle with the oppressive liberal democratic state for survival. White men weren't serfs chained to the land or cast in concrete into a class system like they had been in previous centuries. If they were unhappy where they were, they could simply pack up their gear into a Conestoga wagon and head west, or if they were British, they could emigrate to Canada or Australia, or if they were of an entrepreneurial turn of mind, they could start a business and maybe become a millionaire without all kinds of government interference, so forth and so on. By 1914, the white man ruled most of the globe, and it was quite literally true that the sun never set on the British Empire. White men commanded not only all of Europe, but two huge new continents, America and Australia, which were almost all white and which our forefathers clearly intended to remain white. Now, you remember the White Australia Act? You remember the 1890s when Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act and made sure that almost all of those Chinks that had been hired to work on the railroads were sent back to China where they came from? I know this is hard for a lot of people to grasp, but 100 years ago, pretty much everybody thought the same way we think about most things. I know it's hard to imagine a world wherein racially conscious white people are not a tiny and viciously persecuted minority. And when you needed a cop or a doctor or a contractor or a salesperson in a shop, you actually got a white man or woman who spoke English. But yes, such a world did exist once. I'm old enough to remember just a little of it from my youth. I'm old enough to remember World War I veterans, including my own grandfather. He was actually in the Army Air Corps, and he was a mechanic. He wasn't a fighter pilot on the Western Front or anything like that, but on several occasions he serviced Eddie Rickenbacker's plane, so that's our little historical claim to fame there. Now, what happened to that wonderful world? Well, World War I happened. You know, although I know my World War II history as well as all the other stuff, I have never been one of these National Socialists who was just absolutely fascinated with World War II to the exclusion of everything else. With me, the fascination, the key to the mystery, has always been World War I. Why? Why in God's name did we do it? The world was ours, and yet we threw it all away. Now, I still can't say why with any certainty myself, and I've been reading about and studying about that period all my life. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. Bismarck was right when he predicted that the war would one day start over, as he put it, and I quote, some damned fool thing in the Balkans. But even so, why did every government of Europe decide to go berserk and start slaughtering one another over that one damn fool thing? Kings and dukes and premiers got assassinated all the time in the late 19th and early 20th century. The Empress of Austria herself was stabbed to death by an Italian anarchist, but Austria-Hungary never declared war on Italy because of it. So why 1914? As nearly as I can figure, the white man as a whole, having achieved a pinnacle of civilization, was simply bored with it all. We're like that as a race. When we're winning and on top of things and everything's going smoothly, we get bored and restless, and we look for new challenges and adventures. And in 1914, God help us all, we decided that the way we were going to amuse and occupy ourselves was to have a lovely little war. It would be really tempting to try and blame the Jews for World War I, and they were certainly there. They were certainly participatory in the root causes of the war, going back to the Boer War with the British seizure of the gold and the diamond fields. Then in the middle of the war, the Balfour Declaration and Palestine got involved. Yeah, I mean, the Jews were there, and they are certainly not without blame. But guys, I hate to tell you, this is mostly on us. I think we went to war and slaughtered between 10 and 12 million of the best young men of our racial gene pool because we were just plain bored. Now, the people of the time, especially the young men who were going to have to do the fighting, pretty clearly had no idea what the hell they were getting into. The last really serious European war had been between Prussia and France in 1870, and although it had a few innovations like the first effective machine guns and the first breech-loading rifles with smokeless powder, it was still a war of gallant cavalry charges and banners flying and sabers flashing like the death ride of the Prussian hussars at Sedan, and a lot of people honestly believed that that's what it would be like this time when they decided to lose their marbles in 1914. Now, one of these young men was the British poet Rupert Brooke. He wrote that he, quote-unquote, vaguely imagined a series of heroic feats, vast enterprise, and the applause of crowds. I suppose it was like that for a lot of these bored young men. They were tired of life, either in their drawing rooms or their offices or their factory floors. Rupert Brooke also wrote a series of poems called the 1914 Cycle, which kind of gives us a window into the mindset of the time. Now, I don't normally read poetry on here, but this is from the first poem in the cycle called Peace, wherein Brooke records his reaction to the news of the outbreak of war. Now, God be thanked, who has matched us with his hour, and caught our youth and wakened us from sleeping, with hand made sure, clear eye, and sharpened power, to turn as swimmers into cleanness leaping. Glad from a world grown old and cold and weary, leave the sick hearts that honor could not move, and half men and their dirty songs and dreary, and all the little emptiness of love. Into cleanness leaping my ass. This punk kid had no idea what the hell he was getting himself into. Rupert Brooke died in the spring of 1915 on a troop ship of acute blood poisoning brought on by a mosquito bite. The troop ship was taking him to see his first action at Gallipoli, of all the god-awful places. This is Liam Clancy. And this is what Rupert Brooke was headed for if that mosquito hadn't gotten him first. Can't help but wonder what kind of poems he would have written after he saw this little example of into cleanness leaping on the beach at Suvla Bay.
Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun. They sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. Well, I remember that terrible day when our blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was ready, oh, he'd primed himself well. He rained us with bullets and he showered us with shell, and in 5 minutes flat we were all blown to hell. Nearly blew us back home to Australia, and the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. And we buried ours, and the Turks bury theirs, and it started all over again. Those who were living just try to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big turkey shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I awoke in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, and I wished I were dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying, for no more I'll go waltzing Matilda all around the green bush far and near. For to hump tent and pegs, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. They collected the wounded, the crippled, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The armless, the legless, the blind, the insane, those proud, wounded heroes of Suvla. And when the ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thanked Christ there was no one there waiting for me. To grieve and to mourn and to pity, and the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood there and stared, and they turned all their faces away. So now, every April, I sit on my porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, renewing their dreams of past glory. I see the old men, all tired, stiff and sore, the weary old heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But year after year, the numbers get fewer. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, Waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me? And their ghosts may be heard as they march by the billabong. Who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?
And here's a little homily from Comrade Steve.
My fellow comrades, people who have lied to us, our government, our employers, the manufacturers, the bankers, those who control the economy and our media have lied to us. They've told us we cannot understand the world in which we live and therefore must rely on them to determine what is best for us, and that we cannot take care of things ourselves. This may be true for those of the population who are not white. They may not be able to understand the intricacies of how to take care of their money. They may not be intelligent enough to fix their own appliances. They may not be capable of providing their own food. They may not be smart enough to find independent methods of transporting themselves and their goods. But this is not true of you. You, by nature, were endowed with the intelligence to do these things for yourself. You do not need to have the banker tell you what to do with your money. You only need to know how money works. You, by nature, were given the intelligence to understand money. You know that debt is not good. No matter what lies are being given you by those who want to sell you things you do not need so that they may line their pockets with your money. You know that to obtain the things they want to sell you at the expense of becoming a slave to their banks is a danger to you and your family. This debt is just as much an addiction as any drug is. Addiction is becoming a slave to something that is weaker than you are and that weakens you in the process. This happens by allowing yourself to believe that the thing you are addicted to is stronger than you are. You are a strong white person. Nothing is stronger than you. There is nothing to which you can become addicted that you cannot overcome. We've become addicted to the lies of this society that wants to control us by pushing us into believing that we are weak and must be cared for as children or disabled. They have disabled us with their lies. What are you dependent on? Do you depend on the mechanic to maintain your car? Car is nothing but a cluster of simple electromechanical parts that with some study you can understand and maintain yourself. Once you understand how your transportation works, you can begin to think about and develop your own, better methods of transportation. This is why they want you addicted to the idea that these cars are too difficult for you to understand. This is why they want to keep you weak. Are you dependent on the grocery store to provide your food? You can, in a rather small area, grow much of your own food yourself. This food would provide for yourself, would be less expensive, and would be better for you. This is not a difficult task for you, and will give you the knowledge that you can provide the basics for your own sustenance. You do not need their junk, with all its additives. You do not need their GMOs. Are you dependent on a clothing store to provide you with what you wear? Your mothers and grandmothers produce their own clothes. Clothes that were sensible and wore longer and better than what you spend good money on today. We have been dumbed down so that we have been made to be dependent on those who have a financial interest in keeping us uneducated. We have been forced into sharing our schools with those not of our race, not of our intellectual capacity, so that they can keep us from knowing how easily we may depend on ourselves. They have been like a cruel parent who wants to keep their children enslaved and dependent on them. The chains of our enslavement are like the construction paper chains children make for Christmas trees. These chains are many and are made up of the various lies that are being told to us by those in power in this country. Most of the lies are delivered to us by the media. They are delivered to us in very subtle ways by the messages from the television programs and advertisements. Do not trust the messages of the media. They want to keep you addicted to the economy and society they have created for you to keep you weak. They know that if you were to become awake to their lies, they would lose control of you. You would know your strength and would not need them or their goods or services. Those things that you would not need to get from them would free you from them, and then they would become weaker. Your strength and independence causes them to become weaker. The strength they have today is strength they have stolen from you. Stop listening to their lies. Turn off the television. Learn to provide your own food. Learn to get out of debt. Don't buy into the fantasy of the amusements they offer you if you'll only enslave yourself to their credit cards. Learn to grow what food you can, where you can. Learn to make for yourself what you need to live. Develop your mind and intellect and realize your mental strength. Stop buying the toys by which they control you. Become wise in the use of those things by which they can track you or voyeuristically appear into your life. Do you recognize that they can be, and most probably are, reading the things you post on the internet? Stop giving them this information about you. If you want to let them know what you think, let them realize that you are no longer addicted to their belief that you are their slave. Grow up, white people. You are endowed by nature to be the parents of the world, not the children. You are the most mature of all the beings on the planet. Be what nature intended you to be. There is a cabal of people who want to keep you enslaved on the American plantation. It's time to leave that plantation and move to a land where you can become free to develop into the mature race of humans that nature meant for you to be. As long as you remain outside the homeland area, you remain geographically vulnerable when the struggle for white maturity and independence begins. with their lies and the things they have addicted us to, they have weakened us to the point that we can only take a portion of this country back. The portion that is best suited for us is the Pacific Northwest. When there are enough of us who have broken the chains from our minds and have come to the homeland, the time for struggle will begin.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I would like to discuss another book that was sent to me as a request. And this is a Stolfi book that's entitled Beyond Evil and Tyranny. And this is another biography dealing with the life of Adolf Hitler. You know, right away, I wasn't crazy about the title per se, because it's a rather negative title. But at any rate, I'm always up for another biography dealing with Hitler, dealing with his life. And so I was attracted to this book. Now, this is a book that really claims to be a definitive biography because it tries to deal with a more realistic vision of what was going on, not only externally in Hitler's life, but also what was driving him internally. And, you know, there's a lot of psychologizing about people talk about a failed art career and frustration and those kinds of things. And this is an author that wants to talk about, in a way, the obvious, the importance of nationalism in Hitler's life and how much he was a patron of the arts, not only painting, but also the opera. And how deeply he was moved and influenced by the heroic visions that were presented in opera. This book really takes great pains to demonstrate how Adolf Hitler was a patron of the arts, a lover of the arts. I would really say that it takes this point, which is certainly true, and I think it goes into it and repeats it really in a negative sense, I would say ad nauseum. It belabors this point. To me, I feel almost as if the author is trying to, in a way, manipulate the reader or bribe the reader into a certain opinion, and admittedly a more positive opinion, but still I feel somewhat manipulated by the way this author seems to almost overstate or belabor this notion of art. But he talks about how, for example, Hitler actually attempted with a friend, he attempted to complete an opera or actually write an opera that had been started by Wagner but had never been completed, and it's called Wieland the Smith. That's quite an interesting chapter. So there are parts of this book that are interesting. And I do think the author is correct in saying that Hitler had a view of himself as a savior and as a messenger. And so it's very appropriate that he was a messenger during World War I. And we're told about all the times that he had close calls in his life and he was saved in one way or another. And even the time during World War I when he's having dinner out in the trenches or out in the fields, and he hears this voice that tells him to move, and he moves, and everybody that he was sitting next to, they all get blown up by a hand grenade or a shell or something, and he's able to survive this. So there's a lot of interesting historical facts. But having said that, I also found a kind of tedium in reading this for some reason. The other thing is that while I would say the first part of this book is very much fleshed out about the early years and even the early years of the war, when he starts to talk about the later years of the war, he says that it's much harder in those years to sort of get a handle on what Hitler was really trying to do, what his goals were. The author does point out a lot of strategic mistakes that happened, and the first one had to do with an invasion of England was considered and really needed to be done by late summer of 1940 to get ahead of the autumn weather, and that was called off. And then, of course, you had Operation Barbarossa going into Moscow. And the author says that really, and I've also heard this assessment on the History Channel as well, that really what should have been done is that the German army should have continued pushing into Moscow. But what Hitler was really interested in was apparently the Ukraine and the Crimea for the resources. And so then because of that diversion, that zigzag that the author talks about, he says that was very destructive. And the author actually states, and then kind of drops this idea, that he thinks that the loss was actually a deliberate loss. But the author really never offers any explanation as to what the rationale or reason for this could be. I mean, I understand it's maybe impossible to know why someone else does something, but if this is supposed to be the definitive biography, why would you say something like that and then just drop it? I mean, is the reader supposed to think that this was some sort of a drama, that this was an art performance, that because he was a patron of the arts and because the Ring cycle ends in a kind of a catastrophic way where pretty much everything is lost except for the ring that gets thrown in the water? Are we asked to believe that that's his strategy for a world war? To me, that strains credulity. I mean, however much he loved the opera. So I find this to be a very, you know, it's a rather extreme statement, but it's really not followed up on. The other thing that I think this author kind of drops the ball on is that he states that a way to know a man is to learn about his wife. So he writes a little bit about Eva Braun, but he doesn't really say much about her. He just says, well, she was pleasant, and everyone said she was a very pleasant individual, but it's kind of like a few pages. First of all, I question that premise. I'm not really sure you'd learn very much about Hitler by knowing more about Eva Braun, but if that's important, there's really no follow-up on that. So I think some parts of this were almost tedious, and I think other parts were just kind of undeveloped, in my opinion. Now, it's true that there's a lot of history in this book regarding, for example, the issue of Bavarian separatism and the issues that he was having with that. Apparently, there was someone by the name of Kurt Eisner that was a Bavarian separatist and really represented everything that Hitler disliked. He was Jewish, he was international and Marxist. Really, it's kind of odd that he'd be a Bavarian separatist in that case. But at any rate, but Hitler really, and I think this is true, he needed an organization in order to help him spread his message, but he also chose the National Socialists, or there were actually two parties initially. There was the German Workers' Party, and then there was the National Socialists, and they merged. But he chose, when he joined that very small organization, which I think at that point was the DAP, he really saw organization as a necessary evil, and I think that's basically true. Now, when he was really in his prime, he tended to decisions unilaterally through, really, I'd almost say through meditation and revelation. And when he started to make mistakes was when he was always listening to a lot of other opinions. I mean, that's what it seems to be when you look at the history. Now, as far as him being a patron of the arts, he certainly was, and you can definitely say that he had a very artistic temperament, that he loved art. But the really important thing, of course, was that he had a 14 words mission. And it actually states in this book that he had a very secretive meeting with just a few important military leaders at that point. maybe this was back in '40s, and he states that he has this overriding mission. It's very secretive. So there's a lot of information in this book, but I would warn you that it's a slow read. Okay, and as I say, there are these other things in it, these statements, and particularly at the end of the book, where you're just sort of left hanging. You don't quite know, you're not given enough of a theory or an explanation as to why 1944 and 1945 and even, let's say, 1940, 1941, why those years played out the way that they did. And of course, this is stating the obvious. After Czechoslovakia, it's as if the momentum was lost, because really after the Sudetenland was included, you could certainly, you could make an argument for that, but it was harder for him to make an argument for all of Czechoslovakia in some sense, at least in a strictly German sense. And so the author implies that when it came to England and France and in war in general, that he kind of lost heart. And so that's sort of a weak, in some sense, explanation. But it's as if this book is being written in great detail and then the author kind of drops it. So, of course, we're left, once again, asking ourselves why. And it becomes, of course, that's always a very torturous question. And, of course, that becomes very depressing. And at a certain point, you just have to look away from that question. You have to somehow try to go on from that. So at any rate, if you want a lot of information about particularly Hitler's life in particularly the 1900s and the 20s, then certainly if you understand that this is a slow read. So thank you for listening, and next week, perhaps, or in the following weeks, I'll be reviewing two of the Yaki books, The Emporium and also The Dreamer of the Day. So thank you very much, and hail victory, comrades.
Every war has its songs historically associated with it. This is probably the most famous song associated with World War I. It's a British music hall number called It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Somehow or other, we're not really sure how these things happen, this song became associated with World War I, especially the early parts of World War I, when there was still enthusiasm for the war in Britain, before they brought in the draft and before the casualty lists mounted up into the millions. This particular version is from 1914, and it's sung by the famous Irish tenor John McCormick.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets are paved with gold, sure everyone was gay, singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited, then he shouted to them there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart. his Irish Molly, O. Say, should you not receive it right, and let me know. If I make mistakes in spelling Molly, dear, said he, remember it's the pen that's bad, don't lay the blame on me. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.
The following article appeared recently in U.S. News and World Report, or rather I should say on the U.S. News and World Report website, since the magazine itself is no longer published. I quote, "For the second year in a row, the number of non-Hispanic white deaths in 2013 outweighed the number of white births, signaling an increasingly older and diversified American public. It is a trend that's likely to continue for a while, as traditionally minority groups become the majority of the U.S. population. As a result of its slower growth rate compared with other groups, the number of non-Hispanic white individuals declined to 62.6% of the overall total population in 2013, from 63% in 2012, according to the recent figures from the Census Bureau. A previous report from the Census Bureau showed that the U.S. will become a majority-minority country for the first time in 2043, meaning the total number of black, Asian, Hispanic, and other minority populations will outweigh the non-Hispanic white population, although that demographic will still make up the largest single group." I can hear you say, "Oh, well, at least we'll still be the largest minority, so that's all right then. We really don't have to do anything." Yes, there are some idiots who will actually say that. Ah, but there's a catch. I go back to quoting, "The country as a whole grew a little bit older last year, led by a surge of the retiring age American population and a much slower growth of younger generations. The median age for the U.S. as a whole edged up to 37.6 last year from 37.5 in 2012, census figures showed. The age group 65 and older grew to 44.7 million in 2013, up 3.6% from 2012, while the population younger than 65 grew by just 0.3%. Guess what color all those retiring baby boomers are? Yeah, we'll be the quote-unquote largest minority in America. We will also be a minority of weak, white-haired old farts in a sea of young, strong, vicious blacks and browns who hate us and view us as their natural prey. They will hunt us like snakes hunt birds and small animals. They will assume, probably correctly, that elderly white people have the last reserves in this country of privately held wealth and nice things in their homes. And the elderly white man or woman or couple living alone in the house that they spent their whole lives paying for will be an open invitation to home invasion and butchery, to the point where such crimes probably won't even be reported in the media anymore. It's reaching that point now. For those of us who survive black and brown predation on the streets and in our homes, eventually, under the one-party democratic state which Obama and Hillary Clinton will establish, all of our remaining privately held money and property will be confiscated by the Democrats for redistribution in various ways. And we will all be locked up in state-run nursing homes where we will be cared for by young niggers and Spics and Filipinos and strange gooks from the former Soviet Union who will abuse us in every conceivable kind of way, possibly running gambling games based on how soon each of us will die or how long we can last without water or some such. Why am I unable to get any traction on this? Why in God's name can none of you see this coming? And if you do, what do you think is going to happen to you personally if nothing is done? Do you think that you alone are somehow going to escape it? How? There is only one hope left for the white man on this continent, and that is that we must seize back the Pacific Northwest and make it a homeland for all of our people the world over, in order to survive the coming genocide. Why in God's name can I not make you understand this? And if you really do understand it, why do you sit there staring at your computer paralyzed? Why do thousands of you listen to this podcast every week and never respond at all, if you understand what I'm saying? What is going on in your minds? Now, moving on to another topic. Every day I get emails from people giving me links to various articles and YouTube videos and other things on the internet, along with notes telling me, Harold, you've got to see this, you've got to read this, it's really great! And let me say that most of this internet stuff really is very interesting, and I enjoy reading it and viewing it when I get around to it. Now, sometimes I don't, and when that happens, I need to promise all of you that I am not neglecting you intentionally, and I certainly don't mean to be rude and dismissive. What happens can be any number of things. To tell you that I'm extremely busy wouldn't be truly correct. In point of fact, at any given time, I have about half a dozen things that I need to be doing, but for one reason or another, I can't because I'm waiting on something else to happen or someone else to do something they promised to do or whatever. Now, most of this apparent rudeness occurs when I am interrupted by things that only I can deal with, although some of these interruptions are just deus ex machina stuff, like yesterday, Tuesday, when I normally do the bulk of a week's Radio Free Northwest, I had a medical thing in the afternoon. I get home about 4 o'clock, and I'm about to sit down and really start knocking it out, and then there's an electric power outage that lasts almost 4 hours. But most of these interruptions have to do with the fact that I have yet to find a long-term personal assistant or Martin Borman type who knows what I know and is capable of responding to things like I would respond to them, and men like that are as rare as hen's teeth in the white nationalist movement to begin with. As witness the long histories of various fearless leaders who have spent their entire lives looking for someone who can not only share the load, but take over for them in their absence, which is a topic I won't get into. Now, I have some very good people now here in this area who have helped out immensely so far, but as it happens, two of them are right now engaged in major projects that require pretty much all of their time, and the third man, whom I've leaned on for a long time, has taken on a new job that's working him 60 hours a week, so for the summer at least, looks like I'm doing most of it myself again. And that's fine. I'm the only full-time individual we can afford for right now, and it's not unreasonable to expect me to shoulder the burden of the donkey work in exchange for your support. I don't mind. And after all, what better job is there on earth than serving the 14 words full-time? I am a very fortunate man to be able to do that, and I will always be grateful to those of you who make it possible. Anyway, what I'm driving at here is that when these constant interruptions occur, what happens is that the email is the first to suffer, and your emails with the video and website links of all this stuff that you want me to look at have a tendency to start sliding down in the queue. For example, a man sent me a very good-looking Northwest Front brochure he's ready to print. I glanced over it briefly, spotted a couple of typos and spelling errors, and I told him I'd give it a full proofread and get back to him. Now, that was 5 days ago, and I haven't done it yet. So that's the first thing I want to do here. Apologize to all of you who have been bombarding me with emails and haven't gotten a proper answer, or no answer, or just a monosyllabic grunt. I know I come across as rude and surly and Grandpa Simpson-like at times, and I don't mean to be that way. I get hit with these drop everything, Harold, now, and paying attention to this kind of things, and I just lose my place. Now, the other day, I had a guy over here at the house who politely reminded me that he had sent me a link to an article by a man named Matt Bracken, and he caught me out cold. I remember the link. I simply hadn't looked at it, for what reason I can't recall, so I actually came in here and brought it up on the computer to make sure that I read it. I'm glad he did that, because this article gets into an idea that we in the Northwest Front are going to need to deal with. The article is by Matt Bracken. Like I said, it's called When the Music Stops. You can look it up on the internet for yourself, and I will probably reprint it in the next Northwest Observer. In fact, before I forget, right now, I'm going to drop everything and cut and paste the article into my Observer raw material file to make sure I don't forget. Now, before that, I'll go ahead and lay a third music break on you. Lest we forget, the First World War wasn't just British Tommies in flat helmets singing How It's a Long Way to Tipperary and American Doughboys in Smokey the Bear hats singing Mademoiselle from Armentières. There was another side engaged, you know. Their song was written in the 1840s when the Fatherland was being threatened by an invasion from France, and it became one of the most famous musical anthems during all three wars the Germans fought. It's called Die Wacht am Rhein, The Watch on the Rhine.
I
Okay, I checked my time and I'm running long. I have to keep these podcasts below an hour and 20 minutes so that they can be transferred to commercially available blank CDs, and that means that I don't have time to get into this Matt Bracken article as deeply as it deserves. Now, the article, once again, is by Matt Bracken, B-R-A-C-K-E-N, and it is called When the Music Stops. A quick Google search will bring it up. I won't try to read out the URLs I found because they're all too long and complicated, but I tell you what I will do. I will post the link to this article on Northwest Revolution and Thought Crime in Homeland, and I will ask that all of you take the time to read it because we're going to have a quiz next week. Now, we have spoken for years about the balloon going up, whatever that means to us as individuals. What Matt Bracken does is give a very accurate and most likely prophetic vision of exactly how that will happen. And I agree, it's very likely that the balloon will finally go up, either in the way he describes it with the EBT card system going down, or else it will happen through some kind of Israeli attack on Iran, which will lead to the closing of the Straits of Hormuz and $18 per gallon gasoline and diesel fuel, which will, in turn, eventually come to the same scenario Bracken describes, except by a different and slightly longer route. However, there are two key points on which Mr. Bracken is seriously off base here. Here's your quiz. Read the article and see if you can find what's wrong with the picture he paints. It's not inaccurate. I say again, he may well have nailed and described pretty much exactly how the balloon will finally go up. Nor does he fear to address the issue of race, albeit he does it in polite conservative terminology. And in my book, he gets major points for that. Most conservatives won't go anywhere near the racial issue, won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Now, I'll give you a hint. Remember the old Sherlock Holmes story about the dog that didn't bark in the night? Look for what is not there. Make your comments on the Homeland blog only, please, and get back to me on it. But for now, our time is up. Godot still hasn't arrived, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.